This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochran, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Friday, April 26th. Alberta wants to give itself more power over cities and towns. We'll ask Municipal Affairs Minister Rick McIver why. And the Trudeau government continues to sell its economic plan, even though the budget hasn't resulted in the bounce Liberals hope for. The Power Panel debates the direction they take next. We begin with Alberta's new bill that aims to give the province more power over municipalities. Local leaders say it's an attack on democracy.
This is going to undermine local decision-making, and it's going to hurt our communities. And this is something that Edmontonians never asked for. So I'm at loss to see why, what is the need are for these changes.
There are a few examples where municipal governance definitely can benefit. Everything else is pretty nebulous, not a lot of answers around it, and I think it's bordering on overreach in many cases.
The new bill would, amongst other things, introduce political parties into local municipal politics, starting in Edmonton and Calgary. The bill would also give cabinet the power to repeal bylaws and remove councillors from office. One Edmonton city councillor called this proposed legislation really troubling.
The way it's written right now sounds like it's very much about intimidation and silencing, not about ensuring that those who have, you know, clearly broken the rules and have, you know, have a terrible track record, that have the ability to remove them, right?
To explain why this legislation is needed, Rick McIver is the Alberta Minister of Municipal Affairs, and he joins me now. Minister, welcome to the program. It's good to see you.
It's great to be here, David. Thank you.
This bill, it gives cabinet some big powers, the power to remove municipal councillors from office or call a public referendum to have them removed, to overturn municipal bylaws of any kind. Why does cabinet need such power, and how do you define the public interest threshold that would trigger these?
Well, the most important thing that I would like to say to you about that is cabinet or government already has these powers and essentially always has. So the only thing that's really changed, I suppose, is the time frame and the process from A to B. But the ability, the authority to go from point A to B has been there as long as I remember.
So if it's there, why do you need this legislation? Because people are looking at some of the measures here and seeing this as a bit of overreach by the government.
Well, it can't possibly be overreach because municipal government is 100% within the purview of the provincial government as per Canada's constitution. So those that call it overreach really don't understand how the constitution works. So we're just exerting the authority that we have. And again, the powers that you talk about have always been there. We're certainly making them a little more accessible should they be required. That's true. But there's a few things that have kind of helped bring us to this point. I'll point you to during a time at the end of COVID, the city of Edmonton chose, after we removed our health ministry, removed the masking bylaw, decided to be the provincial government and put a masking bylaw in. Now, we had to actually go and quickly draft a piece of legislation to override that and put it through. And that was fine then. But what would happen if, for example, we were in the middle of the summer break when the legislature wasn't expected to sit for another 3-4 months? Then, of course, we would have had to recall the legislature. Great expense, a lot of trouble and inconvenience for our staff and people that perhaps were on long planned vacations. And we don't want to ever have that happen to occur. So okay. This doesn't expand our power, but it does actually put us in a better position should we have to act in a short period of time.
I understand the Constitution that, in the phrase of Parliament, municipalities are creatures of the legislature and that they are created by a piece of legislation in the provincial Parliament. But municipal governments do exist for a reason, and they are elected for a reason. And just use the example that you cited about Edmonton deciding to go with a masking bylaw or a masking requirement. We know during COVID that the virus was in different conditions and different levels of spread in different municipalities, in different communities, and in different parts of the country. So why not? What is wrong with a local government taking decisions to respond to what its local health authorities are warning them about the local situation in their jurisdiction?
No, it's a provincial government authority, Ministry of Health, and we will municipalities don't get to be the provincial government, nor pretend to be. So that's not anything new, I don't imagine, in other places as well as Alberta.
Okay. Well, I mean, Toronto did have different, you know, restrictions than Ottawa at different times during the Ontario experience. So, but you just don't think this should rest with municipal governments? I mean, what about other policies? Minister, for example, Calgary is going through a process now to review its zoning bylaws. If you don't like where they land on that, is that the sort of thing you might use this new power to overturn?
No, actually, here's an interesting thing. We've had the power in Alberta to overturn municipal zoning bylaws and decisions for a long, long time, and over a decade. And that power has been used exactly zero times. And that's, I think, to the large part, what you can look forward to in the future. We may or may not agree with Calgary's decision, but it's squarely within the authority that our government has given them. And we hope they will make a good decision.
So if these powers already exist, then what is the public policy problem you're trying to solve with this legislation that has alarmed so many people? Because you have the mayors of Edmonton and Calgary and councillors in those cities saying that this could potentially put a chill on their operations. They're worried about being constrained by potentially a government that just doesn't like their agenda at the municipal level intruding and interfering using the powers consolidated under this particular piece of legislation.
The powers are already there. They're already consolidated. It's a little bit quicker to act on them if that comes up right now. But again, I give you the example. We've had the power to overturn planning decisions for over a decade and have used it exactly zero times. I think we hope that's what we can look forward to.
One of the measures in this legislation, Minister, is banning the use of tabulators in municipal elections. Why do you feel the need to? We use those here in Ottawa. I've voted with them a couple of times. It speeds everything up. What's the issue?
I don't have a problem with them, I have to tell you, but here's the issue. A certain percentage of the population is uncomfortable with that idea. So, and some would say, and I'm not even arguing with this, that they might be cheaper and quicker. Those are both good things. But you know what's more important than all of that is that the day after the election, when the winners are all declared, that the public has 100% confidence that those people declared the winners actually got the most votes. And that is actually more important than the cost. It's more important than the speed. It's the confidence, because municipalities do such important work, which we respect very much. And amongst those things, they pass bylaws that people have to obey and other rules and regulations that people have to live by. And the legitimacy of their authority comes from being the duly elected people that won the municipal election. And the less doubt that we can have cast over that, I think, leads to the more confidence that people will have in their local municipal government. And really, then that's the more impetus for them to obey and live by the rules and bylaws that the municipality justifiably and legitimately puts in place by virtue of them being, you know, legitimately elected. So taking away as much doubt from the results as we possibly can, I think could only be a good thing.
But where's the doubt about tabulators? I mean, I know we went through this whole thing in the United States.
I don't have it.
So I do.
There are some, but it's not about me. Some Albertans do doubt it. So rather than have people worry about or doubt the legitimacy of a municipal election, we're going to take away all the doubt that we can. Again, the municipalities have a very important role to play, very important decisions to make, and we need those decisions respected by all of the citizens. So best way to do that is to make sure that whether you like the person who was elected or not, we should all be able to agree that the people sitting in the elected seats got the most votes.
But how widespread is this doubt on tabulators, Minister? I mean, I know you see some of this in you know, the more conspiratorial circles of a population, but I've never seen anything suggesting there is a widespread or even statistically significant concern about the integrity of elections conducted using these counts in Canada. I know there's technical issues with the New Brunswick provincial election more than a decade ago that they sorted out rather quickly, but this is used in municipalities right across the country, and I've seen nothing to challenge the legitimacy of them. So why indulge that by banning them, I wonder?
Zero doubt is better than some doubt when it comes to people accepting the legitimacy of an election. Again, we respect the important job that municipalities do. We don't want any doubt. about the legitimacy of the elections and the legitimacy of every single person that sits in an elected seat for a municipality. We want the public, all of the public, to respect the legitimacy of those people and to respect their decisions. So this is a good way to take a small amount of doubt down to zero, and we think that's well worth it.
Okay, two other things I wanted to just touch on with you very quickly, if I can. You're moving ahead with the plan the Premier mused about to allow political parties in municipal politics, which a lot of the people engaged in that world have pushed back against, saying it's not necessary and not something they particularly want or need. And you're also allowing corporations and unions to make donations of up to $5,000. And some of the criticism of that is there's way more corporations out there than there are unions, and this imbalances a playing field where this sort of activity was disallowed to now allow business interests to have the upper hand. So why go ahead with those two measures, given the concerns that have been raised about it?
Okay, those are two very different questions. But on the terms of political parties, the only place where political parties will be put in place is in Calgary and Edmonton. And even media people have agreed with me that largely there's a political party-like activity already happening. So all we're doing, in fact, right now, there's no ban, no rules around political parties. There's no limitation on it. So we're going to put some reasonable limitations on it. If you're going to behave like a political party, which is fine, then some of the normal reporting requirements that other political parties and other political arenas have to have will apply. And it's no more difficult than that. But to be clear, no one will be required to be part of a political party to run in a municipality. And we are ensuring that the local elections stay local, because we will not be allowing any formal relationship between a provincial or federal provincial or political party and a municipal political party. In other words, local elections will stay local.
So just on the other point, because I did join two thoughts together, you were right in your first response to that. Why allow this sort of corporate money and union money into municipal politics in this way at all, especially in a way that people seem to think will imbalance towards corporate and business interests?
No, I'm not sure I agree with you on that, but I will say this, is that the NDP took that out at one point because their saying was, and they always used air quotes, they're going to take the big money out of politics. But the fact is it wasn't. As much money or more has been spent in the election since, but I think it's less clear who it's coming from. So I think having more clarity about who's giving money who and who's getting the money is that a level of transparency and accountability can only be positive for Alberta and for the elections that happen here. So I'm comfortable with that. I think that the more we know about who's getting money from whom and what they represent actually serves the voters to know who they're voting for, what line of ideology or thought or what emphasis they may have in the decisions they make. And it actually should help voters to make a more informed and better decision. And hopefully that will lead to the best municipal government that we can have in every municipality in Alberta.
Rick McIver, I got a million more questions, but I don't have a million more minutes. We're out of time. I want to thank you for joining me. It's Alberta Minister of Municipal Affairs, Rick McIver. Thank you, sir.
I appreciate your interest today, and I hope to talk to you soon.
It's the end of the first week of testimony in the criminal hush money trial of Donald Trump, and today prosecutors called two more witnesses to the stand. Rona Graff, Trump's former and longtime executive assistant, and Gary Farrow, a banker who worked with Michael Cohen. Their testimony followed multiple days of questioning of former tabloid publisher David Pecker. Pecker told the court about his involvement in a plot to protect Trump's 2016 presidential campaign.
We have another day of court in a freezing courthouse. It's very cold in there. The case is over. You heard what was said, and the case should be over.
Meanwhile, in Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court continues to deliberate whether former President Donald Trump can be prosecuted on charges of trying to subvert the 2020 election. Aaron Blake's a senior political reporter with The Washington Post, and he's been following all of this closely. Aaron, I don't know how you follow all of it closely, because there's a lot there. Thanks for joining us today, man.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start in New York, where we're told the courtroom is very cold, but where David Pecker was back on the witness stand today. I mean, what did we learn in that case today?
Yeah, so the big question and what the prosecution is really setting the stage for here is establishing that these payments, this hush money payment to adult film actress Stormy Daniels that was made by Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, Michael Cohen was then reimbursed by the president himself while he was in office. The idea is proving that this was geared towards the campaign. The crime that Trump is charged with here is falsifying business documents. That's generally a misdemeanor offense, but it can be bumped up to felonies if you can prove that it was done to obscure another crime. And so the idea here is that this was covering up an effort to interfere in the election, basically to hide this payment to deprive people of information in the election. So we saw David Pecker take the stand, the first witness in this case, basically describe meetings with Trump and Michael Cohen going back to 2015 that tied this whole effort to not just Trump's personal reputation, but also to his presidential campaign. And that's a pretty significant, at least threshold issue for the prosecution in this case.
Yes, I mean, that's the key point. And Pecker has spoke about efforts to catch and kill negative stories, or essentially you pay somebody for the right to publish your story and then never publish it. Also planting favorable ones. And he says it was all to help Trump's 2016 campaign. Trump keeps saying the hush money was personal. So, where do you think this is going in court based on what you referenced that we heard today?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, this is a threshold issue. This is something that is necessary for prosecutors to prove in order for these to be considered felonies. I think it's going to be, we had a case a number of years ago that people might remember involving John Edwards, who was a former presidential candidate, a Democrat who actually fathered a child with a woman who was not his wife. And it was somewhat similar in that he was charged in this case. The jury in that case actually believed that this was more personal in nature than campaign oriented. I think there are some significant differences in the two cases here, but that's also telling you why the prosecution felt the need to really drive home this fact with their first witness. And I think the way that David Pecker walked through these things, the meetings that he had with Trump and Cohen, the conversations that he had after that with Cohen, where Cohen emphasized the campaign rather than just Trump's personal life, I think it's really important testimony when it comes to the prosecution actually proving its case.
Okay. Another thing that needs to be decided, another important ruling from the New York Supreme Court, Justice, is on whether Trump has violated the gag order around all of this. So how is his conduct outside the court and on Truth Social and other places playing into this case?
Yeah, it's a really big question, and it's something that we've been waiting a long time for a ruling on. There's a gag order in this case that prevents Trump from talking about the jury, from talking about the judge's daughter who he had attacked, from talking about witnesses. And Trump has proceeded to either say things about those entities or repost things on his social media account that prosecutors allege violated that gag order. The question is, did he actually violate it? And what is going to happen at that point? He's been fined before for violating gag orders in other cases. That seems to be a significant possibility here. But the real question is, given he's continued to do these things even after those previous fines, is the judge going to feel compelled to do something further? The judge can throw somebody in jail for a weekend if they decide that's what's necessary in a case like this. It seems like something that the judge wouldn't want to do because that would set off a whole firestorm. But you also have to protect the proceedings that you're overseeing because you can't just have the defendant continually doing things that are going to undermine the validity of whatever comes of that trial.
Yeah, it certainly creates an impossible situation for the judge, right? When you think about, what Trump has accused of unleashing, in terms of January 6th and some of the extreme elements of his supporters taking the sort of firm action you or me would face in a similar circumstance is a totally different dynamic when it's a former president like Trump. And meanwhile, Aaron, all this is playing out against the backdrop of a presidential campaign. There's public opinion coming out. What is your sense of how this is affecting Trump with Republicans, with moderates? There's some suggestion I read in your reporting that Robert F. Kennedy Jr., of all people, is picking up support from Trump as this rolls out. How is it playing out in the public opinion dynamic in the election year?
Yeah, I think that there is a recognition that the indictments that Donald Trump has faced benefited him, at least when it came to winning the Republican presidential nomination. That's a very different electorate than we see in the general election, where more moderate voters who didn't like Donald Trump during his presidency could potentially look at these things and kind of be reminded of the things that they once didn't like about Donald Trump. His image has actually gotten better since he's been out of office, but there's a real question about whether that's going to hold up over time. I think if you look at this case in particular, there is less concern about it among the American people than his other cases. Less people think that he actually committed a crime here. They think it's a less serious crime that he's accused of committing here. But I do think that you need to separate, to some degree, the legal from the political here. Mm-hmm. Whether Trump is convicted in this case is one question, but whether this reminds people of certain things that they didn't like about Trump is another. And I think when it comes to a case involving paying hush money to an adult film actress and potentially interfering in an election, that kind of hits a lot of the notes of what people didn't like about Trump back then. So we're starting to see some polling on this. We haven't seen huge shifts. We're probably not going to see huge shifts just because our country is so polarized. Mm. But what we have noticed in the last few weeks is that President Biden seems to be gaining a little bit in the national polls. It's basically a tied race now. And President Biden is now not losing as many votes to these third party candidates as we saw before. Some of those Robert F. Kennedy Jr. voters are coming from Trump more so than before. And so to the extent that's a reflection of people kind of reevaluating the candidates in this race as these trials move forward, that could be significant.
You said Americans are less concerned about this case than they are his other cases, of which there are several. But the other one that is playing out simultaneous to this is that the Supreme Court in the United States about whether, because his acts were committed while he was president, whether he can qualify for immunity. Some of the scenarios that have been discussed in this court about hypotheticals of whether it would be okay for a sitting president to use the military to stage a coup to stop an election, if it was an official act versus a personal act, or use the seals to assassinate a political rival, it was an official act. It sounds crazy, but it's not. I mean, what is your sense of where this case in particular is going?
Yeah, just another normal week in American politics where the former president's on trial for paying a porn star, and the Supreme Court is asking the former president's lawyer whether he could lawfully assassinate his political rivals and stage a coup. I'm laughing about it, but it really does kind of reinforce what the Trump era has thrust upon us as a society here, that we're even talking about these things. Look, this immunity thing, I think, is generally acknowledged to be a delay tactic from Trump. The idea was that this could potentially push his trials later and maybe even after the election. It actually seems to be potentially doing that, given the Supreme Court looks like it's going to spend some time with this. But more broadly speaking, you know, it doesn't seem to be that he is going to get the full immunity that he has argued for. Mm. But the Supreme Court does seem interested in addressing more limited forms of immunity for future presidents when it comes to, you know, their official duties and things that are come up well shy of the things that we talked about with SEAL Team 6 and, you know, staging a coup. They want to set some parameters, it would seem, for the future. And that could actually be very relevant if Trump is returned to the White House, because he signaled that he is going to kind of push the bounds of presidential authority. And so I think that at least creates a little bit of an incentive for the Supreme Court to set some parameters for that.
Aaron Blake of The Washington Post, we appreciate it, man. There's a lot of moving parts there, and thanks for walking us through them. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Liberals fanned out across the country this week, selling their economic plan to Canadians. In addition to promoting budget measures, the government announced a massive economic deal with Honda, pushing the promise of jobs and growth, what they call the largest auto investment in Canada's history. It's a big deal, but it's been a tough sell. Recent polls suggest the budget hasn't moved the needle. So this week, we also saw the Prime Minister seize on Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre's controversial stop at a protest camp and his failure to denounce conspiracy theorist Alex Jones.
If Pierre Poilievre wanted to be a responsible leader, I'll even give him the words. This is what he should say. I reject categorically the endorsement and the support of Diagalon and of Alex Jones.
Meanwhile, the Conservatives are trying to capitalize on Trudeau's low popularity by inviting Mark Carney, who is often touted as a possible successor to Trudeau, to give his thoughts on the budget at a parliamentary committee. Time to talk about all of this with the Friday Power Panel. You heard Paul scoffing in the background. Negan Sinclair is a columnist for the Winnipeg Free Press. The CBC's Jason Markusoff is in Calgary. And here with me, scoffing journalist and author Paul Wells and editorial writer for Le Devoir, Marie Vastel. Well, Paul, let's start. I guess this is a normal week now in national politics, a discussion of policy and investment and industrial initiatives and these wedge things on the culture side of things and trying to undermine the leadership. Where do you think we are on the day?
So start at the beginning. I believe Mark Carney will be a candidate for the Liberal leadership at some point. I would not have said that 10 days ago. Cool. If he's not getting ready to run to launch a candidacy, I don't know what the hell he's doing. And fair. There's a growing constituency within the party who think of him as a very good next time candidate, and next time might be next week for all we know. The thing about Poiliev increasingly calling him the next leader is classic post Harper conservative tactics. They ran an ad in 2007-2008 in which Michael Ignatieff harangues Stéphane Dion about failed environment policy, and I wrote a column saying this is to set liberals among themselves. Mm-hmm. And a conservative strategist of the day wrote to me and said, look, if the journalism thing ever doesn't work out, you can come and work for us as a strategist. That's exactly what we're doing. So
instead you went to Substack.
And the rest is for the other panelists. But yeah, Carney is seen as a juicy target of opportunity by the conservatives.
Okay, Nigan, what's your view of this? You can go where you want with this. You want to talk about the economic stuff, talk about the wedge stuff? Or we're just going to focus on this for the whole panel.
Well, I was going to spend some time talking about this Honda investment because I think it's a very classic situation where Doug Ford is using and arguably Trudeau as well, arguing that the investment is happening in the country as opposed to what Mark Carney criticized the budget for, which is not enough investment. And that is a very classic distraction scenario that I think also talks a lot about what Poiliev is doing with his political strategy. We seem to be in the politics of distraction. Maybe we are in the midst of it. Maybe we are at the tail end of it. Who knows? The politics of distractions really looks like we are ignoring the fact that forest fires started this week. And when we talk about the carbon tax, we have to talk about the fact that forest fires started out on the West Coast and will continue throughout Alberta, into Saskatchewan, even into Manitoba. And that forest fire issue is a critical issue involving climate change. And it's going to be very difficult to argue for any situation or any issue around the carbon tax when it comes to discussing forest fires. And then on top of that, you know, when you discuss a Honda investment for EVs, you really just ignore the fact that the Doug Ford's government has completely failed when it comes to the Ring of Fire in terms of Indigenous consultation. And the fact is you cannot just simply move in to try to take lithium or energy of any kind without First Nations consultation. So the fact that Doug Ford hasn't really dealt with that issue whatsoever and that is making multi-billion dollar investment announcements really indicates that both him and perhaps Trudeau are really jumping the gun and focusing much more on economic issues than some of the issues that are really critically facing the country.
Okay, just to correct you on the wildfires, they didn't start this week. The evacuation alerts started this week. Those wildfires have been burning since last year. The winter didn't put some of them out. I mean, which just underscores the seriousness of the issue you're raising, right? The sort of challenges there. So, Maria, I mean, where do you think we are at the end of this week of, you know, budget roll continues, the big Honda deal, and now wedge issues galore?
Well, two different things. I think on the budget, it's true that we haven't seen a bump despite, you know, 4 weeks of selling it, which could be surprising. But I was looking at that Angus Reid poll, I think it was yesterday, where the Conservatives remain 20 points ahead of the Liberals after all this effort to sell, first of all, to throw money at solutions for housing and affordability, and then throwing energy, I guess, at selling it, and the polls haven't really moved. But if you look at the policies, which Angus Reid actually asked about, like pharmacare, dental care, disability benefits, those are all supported by over 70% of respondents, and things like leasing federal land for housing or investing in housing infrastructure, those are at 68-65% support. So there is an appetite for what's in the budget. So I'm curious to see if over time these numbers move if those policy announcements start to percolate in people's minds, or whether it's a little too late and people don't really want to hear it anymore from this government or this prime minister. But there does seem to be potential for movement, especially because both Pierre Poiliev and Justin Trudeau have large unfavorables, so no one really seems that enthusiastic about either of them. But on the wedge issue, I do noticed that the Prime Minister also is more on the offensive as of late, kind of responding to what Pierre Poiliev is doing. And I understand the urge, and I'm not saying it's wrong. I just worry sometimes about the public discourse and public policy. things like the Honda deal announcement yesterday. Someone from CTV asked about job numbers, which is a legitimate question that people ask. And the Prime Minister very instantly sort of barked back with an attack on the Conservatives. I don't know if that really serves public discourse or public policy. If you look at gun control, 4 years later, we still don't have a buyback program. It's a great wedge issue, but perhaps the buyback program is more important than having a wedge issue for the next election. So I understand the urge, and I'm not saying the Liberals are wrong for doing it. I just worry about the level of discourse in this country if we're going down instead of trying to go up. I don't think going up will come from the Conservatives, so I'm not saying...
There's a lot of Liberal supporters probably watching this now saying, you're blaming Trudeau for this?
I'm not blaming Trudeau. I'm just, as a citizen,
A
little bit worried about where things are going. I'm not saying it's Trudeau's fault more than Poilievre's fault, certainly not. And I understand the urge to respond when someone is saying you're spewing bullshit all the time. But I just, as a naive citizen and voter, I'm a little concerned about where things are.
Look, I agree with you. Directionally.
My optimism is hurt.
No, I agree with you. Directionally, the conversation in the country, some people won't even come on shows like this at all to have that conversation. But Jason, just to talk about the budget for a second, as Marie points out, individual components of the policies may be popular, but the whole is less than the sum of its parts when it comes to like winning over either an oversaturated and exhausted electorate with this current government or just a disinterested electorate. I mean, what do you make of the fact that this rollout that was praised from a communications perspective by some people has policies that people like on an individual level, and then the Honda announcement still has people done with this prime minister, at least from what we're seeing today?
I mean, the components are not what Pierre Poilievre is attacking. He's not attacking the housing measures. He's not attacking dental care, pharmacare much. He's certainly not, he hasn't been attacking the capital gains tax that was going to raise some revenue for it. He's not going to be attacking alongside, you know, Doug Ford and Justin Trudeau's Honda announcement or any of his other EV announcements. Those are seemingly, you know, he must sense that they are popular or popular enough not to want to attack. All he has to do is attack the figurehead who's announcing these things, and that seems sufficient. I think if this was the first week of the budget and there'd been no bounce, Liberals would have said, give it time. But as Marie said, this is week four of the budget announcements and still nothing. I think a lot of Liberals and a lot of people out there saw this as the one big inflection point with, you know, and there are not many major inflection points to come before next October. One more budget, the U.S. election maybe, but this seemed to them like a chance to turn the page, and the page has not been turned. The policies may be popular. They may appreciate that they're taking more serious tone on housing, but they're not getting the thanks for it.
Yeah, and you know, to Marie's point, I think it was on the capital gains tax, and as you said, they haven't taken the bait on that fight, it seems. You know, I think the Liberals wanted to bait them into a fight over taxation and fairness, and the Liberals haven't bitten on that. Paul, I just want to go back to Mark Carney for a second. I want to show a statement he issued today in response to this request that he come to OGO, as the committee is known. He says in the statement that was released through the People of Canada 2020, Carney says, "I'm not interested in playing games on such important issues for Canada's economic future. Canadians rightly expect our elected parliamentarians to produce solutions to Canada's challenges rather than performing political stunts or mindlessly repeating simplistic slogans." An interesting rebuttal there. Paul Shachikur was on the show last night saying with Poilievre having such a cemented lead for such a period of time, maybe it's time to start getting him to talk about what his specifics would be, something I think journalists try to do and don't necessarily have a lot of luck. What do you make of that argument from the former bank head there?
I would have responded the same way if, in the unlikely scenario where anyone in Parliament tried to haul me in front of a committee. I think there's a little risk in calling a parliamentary committee a game. There's a lot of people who think that it's the business of Parliament and that it's somebody who wants to spend a lot of his time there might want to pop by. I was struck by the tone, which is of Mr. Carney's release, which is very patrician, very formal, and seems an odd fit for the Poilievre era. But part of me wonders whether he wants to be the next time guy. That he's essentially setting the table for a brief catastrophic Poilievre prime ministership after which Canadians might be yearning for some adult supervision. That's a hell of a bank shot. There's a lot of ifs in that strategy.
I was just going to say, people who think they can manipulate the political universe in a way that aligns with it, and I'm not saying Mr. Carney is doing this, but there have been next great hopes of parties at provincial and federal, and it just doesn't work out. Mm-hmm.
More simply, the fact that Carney is not at all like the person he's facing might be very appealing to liberals. Mm. Almost every new prime minister that I have covered seemed like a horror to the party that they replaced, right? Like, Chrétien seemed like a buffoon to Mulroney conservatives. And Stephen Harper seemed exactly wrong for Canada if you were a Martin liberal. And Justin Trudeau, nice hair, but, you know, not as serious, just not ready, and yet. And so the people who are worst placed to judge the effect that an opponent might have are the people for whom he's an opponent.
Nigam, what's your sense on this? This pushback from Carney saying that essentially this is a stunt and that if you really want to deal with problems, you got to go beyond slogans because the Conservatives have rather effectively stuck with the discipline of, you know, axe attacks, build the homes, fix the budget, stop the crime. I mean, everybody knows these terms now. What do you make of them trying to drag him into committee or entice him into committee, I guess, as a way to get him to criticize the current prime minister and his economic plan?
Yeah, there's two big wins there. One is that he's already criticized the prime minister, and then second is that him by playing the kind of game of is calling the very committee a game is both play into a real kind of conservative narrative. You know, polling comes out recently about who would be the possible next successor, and the three candidates are Melanie Joly and Chrystia Freeland and Mark Carney, and none of them broke the 20% barrier. What did break the 20% barrier was we don't know anyone, or I don't know. That's what Canadian polls said. And so that tells you a lot about, A, whether Trudeau has the ability to be able to run in the next federal election. And I think all signs point to that he's going to make a run for it.
Yeah.
What has he got else left except for to try to cement a legacy or recover a legacy in some kind, because he's really at his last legs politically. And so, and then also there really isn't a big successor. When we're talking about the great next hope, the words Paul Martin came in mind to me, because while Liberals put all of their eggs in the Martin basket, it certainly didn't turn out very well and ended up with three reigns of Stephen Harper. So the reality is that the Liberals should be thinking about not just this upcoming election, but what the next few look like. And if they are looking at losing, then what would be the next successor? And what would be that successor that could take them long-term into at least two elections? And the reality is it needs to be somebody who is well-known to Canadians. And if Justin Trudeau is going to he's going to head into the next election, how much of a Mulroney-like damage will that be? Will it be a complete and abject failure? That's something that really has to be taken very seriously and thought about right now.
Marie, what's your sense of that, right? Because I don't know if I've ever covered a politician who's campaigning who doesn't think they can win, because I think you need that in the back of your mind to have the energy to do what is required. And the minute they lose that, you just see them kind of physically shut down on the campaign trail. There's no indication for me that Trudeau is getting ready to leave, or the people around him are thinking about that.
Yeah.
But how do you think they need to look at the next 18 months they have? Do you think they can credibly get it back, or is it about raising the floor, potentially, of where that next election might go?
I'm not sure. I don't get the sense that he wants to leave. I think this is a very personal fight for him.
I would agree.
He wants to save his legacy, quote-unquote, would be his words, not mine. And this wedge politics with Poilievre, I think he takes very personally that this is not what he wants Canada to look like. And so I don't think he's going anywhere. I don't think anyone is pushing him to go anywhere, quite frankly. I think even if some people think it might be better with someone else, no one's going to push out the guy who essentially saved them from their ashes. Because when Mr. Trudeau came along, the Liberals weren't doing that well.
They were not.
And so I think he will be around. I think this budget was an attempt by them, this new comms strategy, like the talking about the budget 2 weeks ahead. He's like different on social media. I don't really know how to word it, but there's you have seen a change of tone. He's more confrontational, like I was saying, against the Conservatives. So they are trying a few different things. So far, the numbers aren't moving.
Right.
I think they think something like Mr. Poilievre going to visit an encampment and being caught on tape, you know, saying all these things. I won't repeat that word. I saw your face. Probably shouldn't have said BS.
It's okay. It's just a supper time show.
Lies. Yeah. I think that to them, they see this as a positive. But you can't just bank on people getting cold feet about the other guy. I think a lot of people still are asking themselves questions, maybe blue liberals, thinking, I'm tired of Trudeau, but I just can't, I'm not sure about Poilievre. But that's a big, big bet after 9.5 years, maybe 10 if we get to the next one.
So Jason, on that point, you know, to talk about this trip to the protest camp, this is not the first sort of convoy or convoy adjacent event that Pierre Poilievre has attended willingly. And the Liberals are, I think, pretty clearly hoping to drag down his positives, drive up his negatives, because rehabilitating Justin Trudeau's positives is a difficult proposition. Mm-hmm. And so this is why they are putting this front and center. And their view, the argument you hear from Liberals, is that the more people see this kind of stuff, the less they're going to like Pierre Poilievre. I don't know if that's a realistic option for them or just a hope for them at this point. But how do you think this sort of a moment this week could potentially play in the broader political thing? Or is it just something that, as a conservative say, is just nonsense that legacy media is trying to drum up to save their subsidies, which is what I believe they said in their fundraising pitch this week?
That's kind of them. Appreciate that. But look, the Liberals are going to use what they can. Mm-hmm. I would point out that this is not the first time that they've seized on something that some association or some meeting or some attendance next to somebody that Poilievre or the Conservatives have. I think back to that German far-right politician that some of his MPs...
Christine Anderson.
Yes, that's correct. That's the one. You know, I would note that they were, you know, since those have happened, Poilievre has become more popular. Not just that's causation. I'm saying that's in spite of all that. But they will keep trying. They hope that, like with their budget and like all these measures that they're putting out, it's those accumulations will stack up and create an impression. Hasn't happened yet, but you know, they will use the hopes that they can. Contrast that with the steady character assassination, character attacks on leaders successively that Conservatives have done over time. Going back to what Paul was saying about the attacks on Dion early. Mm-hmm. I mean, what strikes me about the Carney thing is that here they're not only attacking, you know, doing all they can to attack the current leader, but they're attacking somebody who hasn't even declared a leadership for some leadership race that doesn't exist. They are, you know, very determined to do all they can to use their ample war chest to attack any and their rhetoric to attack any potential leader they can. The Trudeau government never did that. The Liberals never did that really with Poilievre. And now what they're doing, and from the Prime Minister's mouth, as opposed to from cabinet ministers or some talking head's mouth, it doesn't seem to have worked. On the leadership question, just one last point. You know, I know that Trudeau doesn't seem to want to go at all, but why, you know, the questions as to why the budget hasn't sold, why all these steps that people are impressed with are not actually making an impression, you know, there are two potential answers likely. One is that people are just tired of the Liberals, mm-hmm. in which there's no hope, or people are tired and don't trust the leader specifically. And maybe, again, the accumulation of that may wind up pushing Trudeau to do something he has not wanted to do.
So, Paul, just to go back to the using of the convoy camp visit this week and the political attacks there and the bringing up Alex Jones and the refusal to denounce that endorsement, you know, by noted American conspiracy theorists, you know, there's a lot of analysis that the Prime Minister wants to run again to cement his legacy or save his legacy. It also seems pretty clear that they want to stop Pierre Poilievre. Like, they just fundamentally oppose what he represents, you know, from a value set. Can this sort of a tactic of pointing to going to events like that, is that a thing that can work? Is there fertile ground there, do you think, for them? Well,
there sure is, if nothing else, to rally people who have been voting Liberal anyway or are already reluctant to consider Poilievre. Mm-hmm. In a complex, one of the super simple grade school things that I keep finding it useful to remind people is that in a complex country with 340-odd ridings, many effects can come from an act. So it's possible that Poilievre reminds conservative leading voters that he's plain folks who likes hanging out with plain folks. At the same time, as Liberals and sort of stray sheep, people who've been voting Liberal but really don't like Justin Trudeau will say, well, my God, Where's the country going if this guy gets in and they come home? You know, what's left out is a center, but the center is where Michael Ignatieff fought. So who needs it? You know,
right? Yeah, but you know, Marie. But the, you know, and then the pushback is this is you know, this is the Toronto Star. This is the CBC. This is, you know, there's an attack on CTV that's just gone out on social media from the cause. It's a denounce the media who ask questions about this and attack it. So it plays into the narrative that the conservatives are building, yeah, too, right? That it's the establishment trying to save this guy and calling normal people extremists, and it seems to be fueled. Both sides of this whole argument this week.
But to Paul's point, I don't think people in the quote-unquote center, largely center,
right,
resonate with that, you know, media are lying, the prime minister's lying. I think there is a risk to this strategy by Pierre Poilievre. And, like, the encampment, fine, he wants to go encourage them, fine. The Diaghilon flag, it's inside the RV. It's small. He might not have seen it. Mm-hmm. But then the way he talks to those people, kind of like spewing the anger, and which also, by the way, can backfire because that anger can turn on someone else if someone else is in government and deceives their expectations. But yeah, that spewing the anger, those words that I won't repeat, that to me is what is unbecoming of someone wanting to govern a country. And I think there is a risk that turns off some people of this broad blue tent conservative coalition that maybe don't like that side. It's one thing to talk to normal people, regular people, the guy in his RV who's really, really bummed about the carbon tax. That's one thing. It's all the other stuff around it. The fact that, yeah, he didn't want to pose for a picture in front of that F. Trudeau flag. The fact that, yes, I didn't say that.
No, if you said that, we'd have a problem. But yeah, that's good.
The fact that, you know, he seems to know that it's either inappropriate or could look bad for his own popular campaign.
Yeah.
That's what looks weird to me. Is either he knows it's not a great idea, or politically, or morally, and he's kind of doing it hoping no one finds out. I think that's also where the risk is, where it seems like there's a strategic courting certain people in a certain way.
You know, and you got, it's interesting because we all learned about this because the people in that encampment put it on their social media. It was not on Mr. Poilievre's social media, which is where he likes to put pictures of him meeting with normal Canadian folk. But I wonder, like, he may not have seen the Diaghilon sign and all of these things, and you know, there's no evidence to suggest he did. But I flip it around, and if Justin Trudeau pulled over to a protest group with F. Pierre signs and just dropped in to say hi because they were running those flags, I imagine the criticism will be fierce and intense. You know, I just wonder what you make of the way people view it when it's the leader of the opposition going into an F. Trudeau encampment.
Well, I mean, to be fair, Trudeau has gone to certain protest camps, Indigenous in particular, that do have signs like F. Canada. And while he doesn't appear beside those things, there has been ways in which Trudeau has stopped at certain camps. I want to talk about what Poilievre chose to do, though, by going to this camp. I mean, this was an impromptu stop. It was prompted by the fact that he heard it was a carbon tax camp. And so it plays really into that narrative. And I think in many ways, once you get in that circle, you're in the circle. Whatever is in there is going to be there. And there is this very big Venn diagram with those who hate the carbon tax and those who hate vaccinations, who are burn it all down, and that on top of that are conspiracy theory believers. The fact was that he was there, and he also maybe perhaps has a base to build. I mean, these are likely, certainly coming from Manitoba, I can tell you from firsthand experience, these may be Maxime Bernier supporters, People's Party supporters, that there still needs to be a small base to grow there. That's my maybe optimistic way of thinking about the way maybe he thought that he could build something there. But I would just say that the problem with Trudeau framing Poilievre in these constant Alex Jones and framing him with all these kinds of celebrities in the United States is that some of those are very mainstream people. Like Joe Rogan, for example, is one of the biggest...
Alex Trudeau Jones, though, isn't, right? I mean, no, Alex Jones is not. I mean,
absolutely not the same thing in any way, but it's still kind of an American celebrityism that he's associating with Polyev that could be highly problematic. And I think that Polyev may not have seen, known exactly what he was getting into when it was coming to this protest camp, but certainly he didn't leave, which tells you, I think, a lot about his view of the possibility of that being a voting base. But I just want to emphasize what Marie said, is that that anger, when you stoke that anger is uncontrollable. It's like a fire out of control, and it will come back and hurt you.
So Jason, just a final thought from you. Okay, is this just what we're going to endure between now and the next election? Like little wedge tactics, you know, big culture war sort of arguments about the character and nature of the politicians rather than sort of the ideas and the plans and the policies for the future? Because it sure seems things aren't moving off slogans in a big way in the broader conversation.
You know, the world will turn. There'll be more car companies coming for more electric vehicle plants. There'll be more tax credits for various initiatives and cabinet tours and everything. But it's hard to walk back from the moment when when the opposition leader tells a group of people who are very angry that the prime minister lies all the time. It's also difficult for us to walk back from Justin Trudeau using some social media thing from Alex Jones, who just talked about Pierre Polyev, to say this is, you know, because of something an American pundit said, you shouldn't vote for my opposition rival. I mean, those are just very harsh, extreme things to wind up saying, and, you know, things that are more more personality driven by the leaders, not by their seconds, their number twos or number threes. This is the leaders talking, and they will continue having this trash talk rap battle. And I don't think it's going to get a whole lot better from here till October 2025 or whenever it is.
Yeah. Paul, just last word to you. I mean, I'm not trying to clutch my pearls and wring my hands about this, but there is a directional thing happening in an angry time, in an angry country, in an angry West post-pandemic where things are going in this direction. I mean, do you think this is just where it's going to be for the next 18 months in terms of the high level conversation amongst the leaders?
The Liberals have been very upset for 2 years that Polyev is the voice for angry Canadians, and the Prime Minister is becoming a bit more of a voice of a different cohort of angry Canadians. Mm-hmm. And the old social niceties, I mean, Stephen Harper's politics seemed really quite surprising and raw when he came on the scene. Hmm. And he now seems like a figure of retinue and bashfulness compared to Pierre Polyev.
Yeah, it seems to me if Aaron O'Toole's the leader right now and Trudeau's in this situation, he might think about leaving because, you know, I don't think he'd see the stakes as high. If he, you know, a new leader might turn it over, but I don't think he will because of what's going on there. Gang, always appreciate it. Have a good weekend. Happy Friday. Jason Markusoff, Negan Sinclair, the potty mouth Marie Vestel, and Paul Wells. Thank you. That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochrane. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.